Welcome to Micro College. My name is Jacob Hunt. I am the executive director of Thoreau College, a micro college located in rural southwestern Wisconsin in the United States. Speaking to you in October of 2024. We are currently accepting applications for our Metamorphosis Gap Semester, which will start in late January. Check back soon for information about our summer program, the Field School in July of 2025. And the fall of 2025 Metamorphosis Gap Semester program. Today on the podcast, we are very excited to speak with two folks all the way from the Netherlands, who are the founders of the Bildung Climate School, which ran a 9-week pilot program this summer in Rotterdam. I'm speaking with Rutger Engels and Ginny Servan-Miklos, who are co-founders and initiators of this project. Rutger has a PhD, is an award-winning full professor in developmental psychopathology at the Erasmus University in Rotterdam, and a board member of the venture philanthropy De Vere Bergen. From 2014 to 2018, he was CEO of the Trimbos Institute, the National Institute for Mental Health and Addictions, and a distinguished professor in developmental psychopathology at Utrecht University. From 2018 to 2021, he was the Rector Magnificus of the Erasmus University in Rotterdam. In terms of research excellence and the quality of its degree programs, Erasmus University in Rotterdam is a top public university in Europe and consistently ranked in the top 100 of global university rankings. He's also been involved with a Canadian startup focused on psychedelic treatments and currently is co-founding a specialized mental health clinic for psychedelic-assisted treatments. In recent decades, he has coordinated programs aiming to design, test, and ship interventions for mental health, addictions, resiliency, and personal growth. And he has most recently been involved with setting up the Bildung Climate School in Rotterdam. Jeannie is an engaged environmental educator with 15 years of experience in education practice, research, and advocacy. She currently holds an assistant professorship in behavioral sciences at the Erasmus School of Social and Behavioral Sciences in Rotterdam, in the Netherlands. Her research and education work focuses on developing innovative pedagogies for societal impact. She developed the Experimental Pedagogics Educational Design Framework, co-founded the Bildung Climate School with Professor Engels, and is the author of Pedagogies of Collapse, a Hopeful Education for the End of the World as We Know It. She's a senior fellow of the Comenius Network for Educational Innovators in the Netherlands. She's the founder and chair of the board of the Fair Fight Foundation, an organization that provides girls and women from Zambia, Zimbabwe, and India with mental and physical benefits of martial arts practice, as well as educational support. Ginny is a vocal activist for sustainability and gender equality, advocating for change through public engagements like TEDx, debates, podcasts, and other digital media outlets. She has a BA in politics, philosophy, and economics from the University of Kent, an LLM in international law from the Kent Law School, an MA in international relations from Sciences Po Lille, and a PhD in educational philosophy and psychology from Erasmus University in Rotterdam. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. That's quite a mouthful, those
Thanks.
biographies.
Yes. If you're both are familiar with the podcast, and I think we always like to start rooting these conversations in people's stories, and especially the stories of their education. So I'm wondering if you could think about the period of your life. Your early adulthood, 18, 19, 20 years old. If you could share a bit about where you were, what was your life like? What were the big impacts on you at that age, and how has that shaped where you've gone since? Jeannie, do you want to start?
Sure. So as you mentioned, I was doing at the time my BA and MA degrees as a double degree between Sciences Po Lille and the University of Kent in the UK. I had a passion which I think was passed down to me from my parents who were very Christian. A passion for like helping thy neighbor in a way. And I always wanted to work in nonprofit development work. So that's why I chose to study those subjects at the University of Kent and Sciences Po. And I graduated with a degree in a master's degree in human rights law. And I worked for a number of NGOs in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Caribbean, and Vietnam. So my last mission was around 2009 or something in Vietnam, working on the after effects of the war in Vietnam, and particularly the ongoing repercussions of Agent Orange poisoning in jungles, so villages in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. And I was 22 or 23 at the time, and I wasn't prepared for what I saw there, despite studying this at university. But it's one thing to read case law, it's quite another to go there and see it yourself. I came out of there profoundly disheartened at the nature of humanitarian work, because the kind of realization that I had, and which I later sort of put into words by reading John Stuart Mill, was that by the time you get to clean up after a war, it's too late. And that was the first time that I put my interest to education to prevent such things from happening in the first place. And that's part of John Stuart Mill's theory of change, that the kind of decentralized utopian socialist world that he ended up landing on towards the end of his life was only possible through the kind of education that would create a value system where such utopias were possible. And what I saw in Vietnam was the complete opposite, a complete failure of education, that young American men were prepared to travel across the world to go deposit chemical agents on populations that would poison people for three generations and longer, to me, felt like a failure of humanity and a failure of education. And so it's from that point on that I completely reconverted and did my PhD in education theory and psychology, completely self-taught in that field. But I never once regretted leaving the field of human rights. And in a way, I feel like education is the fundamental human right without which other human rights are not possible. And it is also why, when I learned about the situation of the climate crisis and just how bad our predicament is globally, I always tell my students, of all the things I could be doing, the reason I'm here with you in class and not on a beach in Bali waiting out the end of the world is because I still believe in education as the fundamental tool for transformation. And that is a direct product of my experience. As difficult as it was in those years in my early 20s.
Yeah, I've been delving into your other speaking and podcast and so forth. And your life is you've not shied away from the big challenges. And I think and you do it in such a in you know such a you know an action-oriented kind of way, right? You are and I can see in the work of the Building Climate School, it's right there. I mean, and I do think that's one of the reasons I enjoy working with students of this age, people in their early adulthood are ready to really, they're very morally alive, I would say, especially if they're encouraged to have a space where that can happen. And yeah, I think that shines through in your biography. And thank you for sharing.
Yeah, I mean, action is extremely important to me, and it is something that I talk about. All my education programs are action oriented. I do not have a traditional academic career, so I'm not like Rotor in that sense. I don't have like a traditional scientific career. I felt like we were running out of time in terms of how dire our predicament is, and that only action oriented education and action-oriented work, to me, felt still relevant. Of course, we still need scientists and we still need to do research and all that kind of thing. But in the field that I was in, I felt that if you weren't taking action, then it was a kind of moral failure to sit there and describe how the world is burning without doing something about it. That's just not good enough for me.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah, that's something that I hear from every group of students in some form, right? This is why they come to do something like Thoreau College or these other micro colleges. It's a first step or a form of action to begin with. Thank you. Rutger, what about you? Where were you in that phase of life?
Oh, it's longer ago for sure. Different environment. So I grew up on the countryside in the Netherlands. the north, small village, middle class family. My mother was a social worker, and it's also the area in the Netherlands where, for historical reasons, there are a lot of people that are, there's high unemployment, poverty, and poverty is always relative, I realize that, but still in the Dutch context it is. And so there I grew up, and to be honest, I had a bumpy, difficult teenage years. I once said to my parents, the best day of my life is the day that I left that town, which is a little bit cynical, but and I don't think I would say it again, or still. But I really, so when I was 17, I went to college for a year to do social work, like my mother. I got deeply interested because of her stories in human development, mental health issues, how differences in families exist. So how can it be that people grew up in seeming, it seems that they are living, that they grew up in a similar social context, but they develop, they are, they con develop themselves completely different. So I got really interested in that, and did 1 year social work in Groningen. So that's the big town, and everything is relative compared to the US, but it's big town. And did 1 year social work, then psychology, and I thought I should become a therapist. That was my whole idea. But after a couple of classes, I realized that I think mankind is not really suited with me as a therapist. I don't think that will end well, so to say, because patience is not a characteristic that is really that fits me well. So I decided to do social psychology. I'm interested in groups, and I had a wonderful time, to be honest. I mean, that in that city, vibrant city, student life. I just loved it. I just really liked it. And after that, I finished my master in social psychology, and then I basically it was in a period where there was quite some unemployment. So I was unemployed for 9 months, did all kind of silly jobs. And then I thought, okay, so if there's nothing I can do, I can't get a job, then okay, a PhD. Then I should do a PhD. And I already published my master thesis in a Dutch journal. So I thought, okay, I like writing. And I applied for a few places and ended up in Maastricht, in a really small department of medical sociology and epidemiology. And basically I loved it. I applied there because I really liked the topic, and that was why young people start smoking and drinking. And when I realized after 2 years, having 2 years in that PhD trajectory, I realized that I really like writing. And I think once you realize that, and once you do, and if you develop that skill with good mentoring, I had excellent mentors in that small department. And if you realize how much energy you get out of writing, to be honest, not so much the publishing, but the writing, I think that made a huge difference. And that was very important to me. So yeah, that was, I think, that's from 18 to 28, 29, something like that.
Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, again, yeah, the mental health and addiction, these sorts of things are issues that present yourself, present themselves to you and call out for something to act upon. Yeah. So one thing that stands out, I mean, I think it is a part of what I understand about is being envisioned for the Built and Climate School. You both have these illustrious sort of research backgrounds and academic degrees and so forth, but you are also clearly alive to the other aspects of being human. I think you bring the idea of karate and martial arts through the work of the firefight foundation. But I also know there's movement and dance and music is built into your vision of education. Maybe before we get into the Building Climate School in detail, could you talk a little bit about those out non-academic or the other parts of yourselves that you're bringing into this work?
Yeah, and that's something that I think kind of one of the reasons that Vatr and I worked well together is that was something that I think you were looking for, Vatr, that idea of embodied learning, and that was something that I brought to the table. I've been practicing martial arts for 20 years. I have a second dan black belt in Shitori karate, and I practiced all kinds of other arts. I've been high level. I was a high-level athlete in a different sport in horse riding earlier in my life. So I had always very much a contact with like nature, with animals, you know, working with knee-deep in mud in winter to muck out the horse stables. And then moving to martial arts. So when I talked about my experiences in Vietnam and, you know, processing that very difficult, the things that I saw a lot of suffering, especially in children. That were deeply affected by Agent Orange in the jungles of Vietnam, and that were receiving no care, no help. Nobody gave much thought to what was happening to these people. As a young woman, it was actually quite traumatizing. And I used the kind of embodied cognition that I gained through karate, and I was doing kung fu at the time as well, to process some of my anxiety, some of my post-traumatic stress response. I do credit karate for saving my sanity a couple of times in my life when I've been through really difficult experiences. And it was that insight that brought me to create the Fair Fight Foundation because I wanted to support other girls who were, I mean, especially for young women from childhood. I mean, Simone de Beauvoir showed this very explicitly in The Second Sex, but it's still true today that women are not encouraged to move much, you know, as a way to process stress and anxiety, especially in the cultures where you work in India, in sub-Saharan Africa, in Zambia, Zimbabwe. And then when I started, I described this in my book very explicitly. I had a terrible time with eco-depression when I first started working in sustainability education, 2 years of anxiety and depression, of just not being able to cope with, like, oh my God, what is happening to this world? And it was at a time where still other people seemed to not have cottoned on to how serious this was. And I was just like shouting at a wall. I couldn't get through to my colleagues. And it was around the time of COVID as well. You know, what do you do when you're locked up at home and you're like shouting at a wall, like, no, this is not some random event. This is not like, oh, everything will be fine again in 5 years. No, this is the beginning of a process of collapse that is only going to accelerate. And so when things get too much, out comes the gi, the belt, and, you know, and I've added to that practice since then with more mindfulness, with more like breath work, and so I've added practices to that that I now teach my students as well. But the point is, you can't. Well, it's a very well-known cliche that you can't save the world if you can't help yourself. You have got to be in a fighting shape, literally and figuratively, to be able to do this work that we do, and it is. It's hard, you know. I have young people have existential crisis meltdowns on me all the time. I teach them these things as basic coping skills. I'm like, it's going to get hard for you. This program, the programs that we teach are difficult. There's hard stuff. The world is not going to get any easier to process. You're going to be faced with a lot of stress. So here are some tools to just literally evacuate that stress from your body, because you can't walk around with insomnia and anxiety. And I know what I'm talking about because I deal with that a lot. You have to find some way to just keep going to evacuate. You can't keep storing that in, because that is a recipe for burnout. That is a recipe for depression. That's a recipe for all kinds of really unproductive, unaction-oriented. My research showed earlier, before I started the Building Climate School, I had done research that showed that if you just teach students the facts, they just fall into depression. Duh. So that was part of that process. And it's still all the student feedback is that the movement So in the Build and Climb School, they loved the reflection track with our boxing coach. That was like their favorite thing from the Build and Climb School.
Yeah, that's that those elements are so powerful. I really was like got excited to hear that as part of what you were doing, and I wanted to also share. My wife grew up in Azerbaijan in the former Soviet Union, in a somewhat developing country. And when I described the Fair Fight Foundation and just the idea of teaching martial arts in the places that you are, she like was, yeah, oh yeah, that's awesome. That's exactly right. And I've seen, her coming out of a traumatic kind of cultural situation, things like her thing has been weightlifting, like Olympic weightlifting. And yeah, so, I think, and also students, just embodied practices wherever they are, I think are exactly right. It's a key part of the work that we're doing in these schools. Yeah. What about you, Rutger? What are your practices?
I don't know, to be honest. Working is a practice for sure. No, but seriously, I think the we are social animals, and I think the if it comes to dealing with stress or deep worries about where the world is going, I think what helps for me is my social relationships, my friends, family, and I think I think at the end of the day, and this I don't that will also save us. So the solution is in our in the social in the social networks, and for me personally too. So I think that if you ask me what is your coping strategy, it's definitely not boxing, or karate or whatever. Maybe a little bit of dance, but definitely listening to music and et cetera, but primarily social.
Wonderful. So, okay, let's talk about the Bildung Climate School. First of all, Bildung, we've had Lena Rachel Anderson, one of the authors of The Nordic Secret, has been on the podcast a couple of times. It really is that book and her work has fleshed out the particular definition of that word Bildung. But for those who might not have heard that, or and also in your context, what is that word? Why is this word is part of the name of this project, and what does Bildung mean to you?
So I think this goes back to the genesis of how Rutger and I ended up working together, because we have like quite different backgrounds and life stories, but it was around Lena Anderson's work that we got in contact, because we, by some random chance of life, ended up in the same research group at the School of Social Sciences, because I followed my the leader of the group at the time was somebody that I'd worked for in the previous institution where I worked. So I followed her there, and Rutger just had stepped down from the rectorship and then came to this group as well. But I never saw Rutger because he was always taking the meetings from his car. So we never really had like a chance to talk. But it was when he started talking about the fact that he'd read this amazing book, The Nordic Secret by Lena Rachel Anderson. And I was like, wait a minute, but I know Lena, and I met Lena in 2016. When I remember that first, it was like one of the first meetings of Bildung in the Netherlands, just around the time that Michiel and Dirk founded the Bildung Academy in Amsterdam. And I hadn't done much with Bildung at the time. I remember having wonderful conversations with Lena at that conference. And then during COVID, she got back in contact with me. I was like, hey, I'm trying to set up this global building network. Would you be like interested in contributing? I don't remember, like she wanted me to help for a talk or something for we were doing online events, of course, because everything was locked down at the time anyways. So then I was like, yeah, sure. And she had given me an early copy of The Nordic Secret to review and those kinds of things. And when I was So I'd started my work on my book, Pedagogies of Collapse, and collecting all my educational experience throughout the years. And I was looking for an action point. I was like, okay, so here's all this learning, and I've read all this theory and all this critical pedagogy and all this stuff, but what do we do? And I remember sitting down with Lena going, okay, Lena, this is great, but what do we do? And it was when I met Rutger and we talked about that, and Rutger immediately goes, where the action is. Rutger is immediately like, no, we have to do this. And then I come up with an idea. He's like, no, that's not big enough. We need to make it bigger. And so to answer your question of how we understand Bildung, there are three elements that I really got from the history of Bildung. The first is that it was inclusive, that it was for working class farmhands and focused on vocational skills like farming. I was very inspired by the visit to the Christiansted farm outside Copenhagen, which was one of the first folk high schools, which is focused on farming skills. So concrete practical skills, connecting young people with a future profession that is relevant for the world that they needed then. And I see the applicability today. The second point is the moral and aesthetic personal development that these young people were getting. So access to like ethical citizenship, Lena credits the folk high schools with setting the foundations for the social democracy in Scandinavia. And I think that is a fair point to make, again, following this John Stuart Mill theory of change. And then there was this idea of personal development, which I think was quite foreign in the 19th century, except for like wealthy bourgeois or lords, you know, Lord Byron type people, and the democratization of self-efficacy, self-direction, self-development. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Rutger, but I think those were the three like aspects of Bildung that really appealed to us.
Yeah, and I think I agree, and I mean, to be honest, I mean our university has 40,000 students, and if you go to a like class of economics, so if you go to first year economics or first year psychology, you will be there with hundreds and hundreds of students having in big halls, lecture halls. So the question is actually, so there are a couple of issues. Are we really paying attention to personal development, to human development for people who are in a formative period of their life, right? Because that's what it is between if people leave their homes, live on their own, and it's a formative period in their life. It's a big transition.
Yeah.
And we primarily pay attention to the ratio, right? To we are. Yeah, we leverage our academic knowledge, but the skills part, the personal development part, is really lacking, and that is needed, we think, and we are not doing a great job, to be honest. And there are exceptions; there are definitely exceptions, and our university is not different than other universities. But then I was reading the Nordic Sigfrid and I thought, oh, okay, so this is a different model. It's social. It's inherently social. It's more inclusive. I mean, you can ask yourself whether it's still inclusive and whether microcolleges are inclusive, etc. But that's a difference, whether it's accessible for everybody. But that point of like more full development and was, for instance, like a big turn on when I read the Nordic Secret and started to talk with Jeannie about this work.
Yeah, so this question of inclusivity and also sort of class structure and something that I've learned and started to hear about in learning about your project is education systems are quite different from country to country and in ways that are surprising, I think, to when you start looking into it, talking to high school students, for example, like I was talking to our local high school today and explaining what it was like to go to school in the Netherlands or in Korea, for example. We have several Korean students and the systems are quite different. I think that seems to be actually an important part of your project in particular. There are various streams and stratifications within the Dutch education system that have different kind of visions of human development actually played into them and different kind of pedagogies at work. So maybe can you talk about that a little bit? Like what are the who is the audience? Who are the folks that the Bildung Climate School is intended for?
Yeah, so I can give it a start. So the Bildung Climate School is focusing on a the climate crisis. And it's really clear that that the skills we need for human survival in the next, let's say, 20, 30, 40 years is not only doesn't come from only one part of our brain. So if we have like 90% of all academics, I don't know how it will go with the survival of the species, to be honest. So we need people with vocational skills, but these are valued very low in at least in our country. But we think we should appreciate them because we need them. And we need not only people with vocational skills, we also need people who can have like a wide range of skills. So the idea was to put these students together, put kids from with a vocational background, student background, and from we call it University of Applied Sciences and university together, and that's what we developed the program, and the pilot was a 9-week intensive program where we put the students from different streams basically, which hardly interact. I don't think they interact in real life, and not even speaking in like a in a educational context. And we decided to put them together and put them through the same program.
These other streams, just to sort of interrupt, they are separating as early as 11 years old, right? People are
Yeah,
being.
it started with about 12. At high school. So yeah, that's the how do I say this nicely? That's a part of the Dutch system I definitely dislike, and is dysfunctional. So that on the age of 12, after primary school, we put them in three different tracks, and one is vocational, 4 years. The other one is preparing for applied sciences, University of Applied Sciences. That is 5 years, and then we call it gymnasium, like pre-university training, 6 years. And it's really hard to go from one to the other. You can't do that at high school. And of course, what you can do if you finish vocational training, then you can go to the applied sciences and then you go to university. But of course, you lose then 3, 4 years more than. So for late bloomers, this is a horrible system. But it is what it is. So you end up with the different streams and with different career trajectories, right? So, yeah, we can't change though. I mean, to change that is a different, it's quite difficult. But we thought, okay, theoretically, we need people that have different, have a variety of skills. And we need also multidisciplinarity in its true form. So we decided, okay, we make a program that is based on Bildung, but puts those three streams together, which is, yeah, I don't know. It's hard, but we decided to do that. Anything to add, Jeannie?
So I'm not Dutch, actually. I'm French. I had a weird childhood. I grew up part of my primary school in the Netherlands, but I moved around a lot. So I part of it in France, part of it in Belgium. Was in the UK. Was also in Singapore for a bit. So I've seen a lot of education systems, and the Dutch system is just weird. I wrote in Pedagogies of Collapse that it is easier to get a girl from the slums of Zimbabwe to university than it is to get a kid that has been selected for vocational education in the Netherlands to that same pathway. So in France, you only separate around the age of 15, 16. So the lycée, where then you'll have some people who go to Lycée Technique and some people who go to the general lyceum. But what we call college in France, which is the middle part between, say, 11 and 15, everyone's still kind of together. And so there was a much bigger social diversity within my college experience than I see. So I did 2 years of research in the VMBOs, which is the pre-vocational trainings. And that research really broke my heart. Admittedly, I'm like a very sensitive person, but I interviewed a lot of these kids, especially through the COVID period. And I was so fed up of hearing brilliant 15-year-olds telling me they were too dumb to do a scientific education that they were too dumb to. They'd never even bothered going to the university campus, which is on the other side of the river. So Rotterdam's like bisected by the Maas River, and it's like two different worlds. That I've now this week I took some of my students from the university program to visit the Talent Hub, which is one of run by the vocational school for school dropouts from the vocational schools, and they had never met students from the vocational program before, and the vocational students that came to present had never met a university student before. This just like the insanity of this, how to create a divided and polarized society 101.
Yeah, that's exactly, we of course here in the midst of election season in the United States, and some of the divisions and polarizations happening here are right along educational lines. So think about people's university background, that is another some of the ways that those divisions start to be reified. When a person never meets or talks to someone from a different background, it's really hard to work together as a community or as a society or a country.
I think Retro and I were both driven also by our personal experiences. I think, well, Retro is the first generation, to go to university. My family, so my grandmother was like a cotton mill worker in northern France. And some of, I have a very big family, Catholics, but like some of us went to university, others didn't. And so I was very aware of the differences in culture in a way that when I was working in the liberal arts college, everybody there seemed to just take it for granted that of course you go to university and like that's what you do, and just blithely unaware of the lives of ordinary working class people in the south of the city. And I was doing volunteering work as an academic ambassador for a foundation called the Giovanni van Bronckhorst. He's a, like a Dutch football player, and he has a foundation in Feyenoord, which is where the big football club of Rotterdam is. Football, by the way, that's soccer.
Yep. Thank you for the translation. Yeah.
And it was to help these kids, so more primary school, but I got to see some of the social challenges in the south of the city through the, especially the behavior of these kids. I taught karate classes for these kids to help them like calm down a bit and focus. Whoa, the behavioral challenges with
Wow.
some of these kids, the smartphones addictions, the like trauma from COVID. Around the time that they were taking the CITO test, they had like divorce in the family, death in the family, a parent that'd be incarcerated. I think you see a lot of these challenges in the US as well, in some of like the inner cities and stuff. So that was all happening there. And I'm like, you're deciding this child's life on the basis of very circumstantial things. Also, immigrating to the Netherlands, and then you have to learn Dutch. I mean, I met a lot of kids through the Giovanni van Bronckhorst Foundation that were Ukrainian. And I was like, whoa, you learned Dutch in 1 year? But still not good enough to get a good enough score to go to the gymnasium. And what I call the Dutch system is a finely tuned machine for class reproduction, because ultimately the people who go to the vocational schools are more from migrant backgrounds and more from lower socioeconomic classes. And the people who go to university are overwhelmingly from upper and middle classes. And so you have this reproduction that, and then you see the, in my view, I draw a direct link between that and the rise of populist parties in the Netherlands that are now trying to literally break higher education in this country by cutting all the funding. So we reap what we sow in a way. The university, I think Rotrou was the first rector to set foot in a vocational school. The universities far too long have also contributed to this idea that theory is better, that scientific education is better. And what we're saying is you're not going to survive the climate crisis without people who can do regenerative farming, mend solar panels, fix the dikes when they're broken. Reminder, Rotterdam is up to 7 meters below sea level.
Wow, 7 meters. Yeah. Wow. So we've been teasing people all along here. The Bildung Climate School. So I mentioned it was a 9-week pilot program this summer. Can just describe how many people and what went on during these 9 weeks?
That's where you want to do that, or you want me to describe it?
Yo, you gave a lot of these classes. I think you should explain it. I will talk about the research, okay? Because I think that it's really important to elaborate a little bit on that, because what we've figured out when we developed this whole program, and also because it's the start and we are now developing the next pilot and then the full-fledged programs, is that there's hardly any research done on Bildung. So whether the Bildung, what are the working mechanisms of that, like the folk high schools, and how effective it is in human, and not even scores, right? And even how many kids are going to university and finish university quicker than those who didn't go to folk high school. And folk high school is a 6-month program, like what, like I don't know, 15%, 10% of the kids in Denmark do after high school. But the same with the micro colleges, to be honest. When I dived into that, and we had a conversation, is that I realized it's kind of interesting, but also bizarre that there's no research. Because if you're from an educational perspective, from a development perspective, you want to know what works, right? And you do it on your gut feeling and your intuition, but also data help. So we have to go back to the program
Yes.
development.
So you'll see there's like Rutger and I think the reason this project works is because we are very complementary. And so Rutger, with all his years of experience in running large-scale research programs, is running the research program for the climate school. And me, with more my background as like a, innovative educator, I'm running the education side of things. So what we did is we wanted to test, first of all, we wanted to test whether it was possible to get the three streams together in the same room and like working together. We wanted to test the framework that you talked about the experimental pedagogics framework, which is a framework that I have been developing incrementally since 2019. And we wanted to see, does it work on this program? So we tested that, and could we offer this range of like artistic, embodied, and theoretical knowledges to the same group of students. So those were like broadly the three things that we tested. We'll talk about specifically about the resilience and eco-anxiety side of the research. But in the educational design of the climate school, it was 9 weeks. It had to be extracurricular because when you start something that pioneering and you need your first data, it's very difficult to get it like in a program. So we did extracurricular. The kids would come after their regular school hours, so like from 3 to 5, in a like municipal reclaimed building in the south of the city. And we built it up. We built the program, so 2 classes a week, and also running a project track alongside. So for the classes, we used the experimental pedagogics framework. The experimental pedagogics framework is a method for designing education that I developed as a result of my frustration with the fact that you were either doing education design from like the constructive alignment cognitive sort of paradigm, which is what we call here education sciences, or you were doing critical pedagogy with all the very contentious issues that that's having in the US right now and all the connotations that that has. And I was like, you cannot just take kids from like performance-based schooling straight to let's change the world and solve climate change without a step-by-step approach. And so the experimental pedagogics approach is you start with cognition, but then you move on to values and individual sort of existential framework on why am I here? What are my values? Who am I as a person? So that's level two. Level three is how do we function in groups? How do we have conversations? How do we work together? Very important group dynamics in these kind of mixed groups. The level four is how do we build communities? How do we work towards creating cohesive, complementary, democratic communities in our neighborhood, in our city? And then we go to, okay, now let's tackle global problems. Let's talk about climate change. And of course, the sustainability theme is throughout all of these. So, for instance, in the first layer, we talk about cognitive biases and how, I'm sorry, I use a lot of swear words in my classes because I detest academic jargon when I'm teaching. So, one of the titles of the lectures was, How Your Brain Fucks With You on Climate Issues. But we're talking about, this kind of pedagogical approach of saying, I refuse to use jargon because I'm talking to vocational kids who are only working with their hands. And the minute you throw a theory in there, they're like giving up and scrolling on their phone. So for each of these levels, we had different pedagogies. So dancing and martial arts, breathing in the more individual levels. We had group musical composition for the group level. We had more like we had a friend of ours, Derek Lorbach, give a class on could the students create a sustainable financial farming model. We had a philosopher who gave a case dilemmas about the case that she gave them was if you were the last person, the last human on earth, would you protect or destroy nature? And you don't need a degree in philosophy to answer that. And so all the kids, the vocational kids, the university kids all got together around these very tangible experience-based questions. And then the projects, that's something that we still need to work on in the next pilot. But the idea was that in each project group, there would be at least one student from each of the three strands, and they had to use their skills in a complementary manner to create a video about the theme for this pilot was sustainable food or unsustainable food. And what we saw is that in the beginning, there was a lot of tension between the vocational and university students, especially. And after like 10 days, the mentor from the vocational college that was supporting us throughout the program, she comes to me, she's like, I got a couple of my students who are thinking of dropping out. And I'm like, dropping out? Why would they want to drop out? And I talk to these students and they're like, yeah, the university students, they're making me feel dumb. I don't feel like I belong here. They're using all these complicated words. And I saw these university students, as soon as you mentioned project, they're like, I want to do econometrics. I want to like set up a study and survey and like do some regression. And the vocational students were like, well, then bye. So I sat them all in a whole group and was like, okay, what you just told me, say it to them. And yeah, so then outright in the circle, they're like, yeah, you guys make me feel dumb and you make me feel like I don't belong here and that this is your program and that we do it your way or the highway. These university students were shocked. They were like, oh, I'm part of the problem. And that was a beautiful moment. And from then on, especially using the movement where everybody is, you know, doesn't matter, you have a degree in economics, you still have to move.
Thank you.
We had this like martial arts and dance classes where everybody's equal again. And also the practical, like the art classes, we had a mask making workshop. And the vocational students were better at working with their hands. Surprise.
Amazing.
And so through these pedagogies, we had a really cohesive group. And you have to know that we had zero dropouts from the vocational school.
Wow.
Everybody was telling us, your vocational kids are not going to finish the program, they're going to drop out. And even though their own school finished about a month before our program, they were coming into Rotterdam only for the 2 hours of our program, which is like, says a lot, I think.
Were those the university students, were they able to modify their language in a way that met that request or the observation from the vocational students?
Most of them, yes. So we use journaling, like reflective diaries, and I saw in the diaries, especially from the university students, that they were shocked. It just had never occurred to them. And we had quite a few international students who were unaware of what a vocational student even was. And so there was really some like whoa moments on part of the university students. And in the end, they were just friends, you know, by the end of this. We had a really nice closing ceremony and all of that. And if you saw them in the group together by the end, you couldn't tell who was a vocational student or who was. Yeah, so one of the things that they talked about was how much it felt like a third place, the climate school.
Yeah, and it was only 9 weeks.
Yeah, four
Only
hours a
2 hours a
week.
day. Yeah. Excellent. Wow. That's wonderful. So Rico, you want to talk some more about the research component of this, or like how was that structured, and what will be done with that, is that what you've learned?
Yeah, so so we thought it was a good idea before we launch a full-fledged full-time program that we do some pilots. And this pilot was specifically aimed at what happens if you put those three groups together in a similar program with similar pedagogics. How does it play out? So we did interviews pre and post, so before the program, after the program, with each of the students, with some parents as well. We So that was more qualitative, what Jeannie already told you. So we have also the content of the work. So the journaling, if they do reflective journaling, we actually you have that contact. You can also look whether there are changes over time, over the course of a program in how they what they write about. On a quantitative level, we actually did two things. So we had two approaches. One is, again, pre and post. We focus primarily here on so in the qualitative analysis and data collection, we focused also on group processes. In the quantitative, we focused on eco, anxiety, and resiliency. And the idea is, of course, that during over the 9 weeks, they feel more comfortable and able to at least have a little bit of control over their angst. That's what you hope, their fears. So we measured it pre and post eco anxiety and resiliency, and these are just like standardized instruments, self-report instruments. What we also did is before each lesson, we measured the same concepts, but then with a few items. And so we had over the 19 week, we had 18 assessments. So you can also look at differences after specific lessons or weeks. That's called ecologically momentary assessments, where you have more really small, and so the kids get an alert on their iPhone at a specific time, and then they have to fill in a few questions and for like 30 seconds, and that's it. And they do that before. And the idea was that there was a theoretical idea, and we find an effect of the program on eco anxiety, which is great. So it goes down. But of course, you can see individual differences. And for some, with those 18 assessments, you can see that for some of these kids, the anxiety goes up in the beginning because they start to think about this topic way more. We talk about it, we show them videos. This is very explicit, this is in your face. And of course, one of the strategies we as humans have to deal with frightening stimuli, like stuff about the climate crisis, is avoidance, right? That's what we often do. But if it's in your face, like what is Jeannie is talking about and the other lecturers, and then it's that you can't. So in some of the kids, you see that it goes up, the eco anxiety in the beginning, and then it goes down. So I think, and so this is not only to show that the program is effective, but also how we can change the program to make it to improve it actually. And so that's what we do.
Yeah, something I've really appreciated. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet. I think is it out in the is it published yet?
It comes out on the 28th of November.
Right. Yeah, this is again Pedagogies of Collapse. I mean, hearing you talk about it, I mean, you, as I mentioned at the beginning, yeah, really, highlight, or I'm assuming you're bringing this to the students, right? The very like dire circumstances of the world, as it is, not just temperatures, but the seas and biodiversity loss and pollution and all of these big issues. That if you're only marinating in those facts, that data, it is you should be depressed, right? And that's an appropriate response. But I think you from what I can I appreciated the way that you've developed a version, an understanding of this, a process of working through grief, a version of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross kind of concepts of the cycle of grieving, and that's something that I see certainly in the young people who are show up here at Thoreau College who choose to do something like this. They are people in some phase in that process, and so it's very. It was a very useful idea for me to learn about, and look forward to the book for that reason. But it seems it needs to be addressed as you're doing very consciously. That's it is if you're going to come to a point of avoidance, if you want the goal is to have people to take action and not just retreat into themselves, that needs to be very explicitly the goal, and there needs to be strategies to bring that about.
And it should be fun. And it should be fun. I
Yeah.
mean, it's not. I mean, it's not that the it's not a that serious program, right? I mean, so there should be a balance. I mean, I worry about status of the world, but I also have fun, and otherwise because that's my own regulation, right? And you have to teach that to kids too,
We
because
had
otherwise they get disturbingly depressed.
That's the conversation we had actually with the kids in the climate school when we had the dance class. There was a one student who was like, "Well, I feel so guilty about the state of the world and my contribution to this that I don't feel like dancing because I don't feel like I have a right to do that." And I really told them the day we give up on dancing is the day we give up on humanity. This is something that's really important to me and how I keep going. People ask me that a lot. I've been branded and I accept that label as a collapsologist, which is like a French undercurrent of thinking about like the study of civilizational collapse. I certainly do not shy away from the facts and what I wrote, and I stand by that. And every day seems to want to prove that I was right in that. I don't think we will avoid some kind of collapse of the world as we know it in my lifetime, certainly. Definitely in the lifetime of the students that we have with us. And what I say is that the answer to that cannot be a pathway that is only difficult and unpleasant and that is just full of suffering, because we may still fail. That is something that I keep repeating. We may do all of this and still fail and still collapse. And so if you burn yourself out, if you make your life miserable, and this is why we see such high activist burnout in this kind of in environmental so I was involved with some environmental activist groups, and we see very high levels of people who don't show up to meetings because their mental health is not good, people with burnout, people who just drop out because they can't deal anymore. The path to get there, the journey must be one that we want to take. It must be a journey where you look back and go, no matter what happens, whether we fail or not or succeed, I don't regret taking that journey. I don't regret, it was enjoyable. As Rutger said, I met people along the way that, made me want to get up out of bed in the morning, made me want to keep fighting for this. I had beautiful moments of like sharing food with people. Sharing food's a big thing. I know I'm French, but like we will have three meals together at the climate school, because that's a foundational part of social bonding. We danced together, and those memories, I had so much fun teaching the climate school, and it comes back in all the interviews. We came because it was fun. Like, hey, let's talk about the end of the world and at the end say that it was fun. And yeah, we do see the eco anxiety is worse in the beginning because a lot of these students genuinely had no idea. And in the first class, I gave an overview of planetary boundaries, as I do in the book, as I did in the podcast with Lena. Like, okay, here's climate change. This is not even the worst of our problems. Biodiversity collapse. Let me tell you about PFAS and plastic pollution. Oh, by the way, the oceans. Yeah, that's not good either. Let's talk about wilderness collapse and air pollution. And by the end, they're like, whoa. But I sincerely believe that it is essential to tell young people the truth. I think it's been bad faith to say, oh, no, we can't tell them the truth because they'll get depressed. No. The reason they'll get depressed is because you tell them the truth and then you don't do anything about it. That's what's depressing. But to effectively lie to young people and promise them that Elon Musk has the answer, or that, like, oh no, we just need to build more solar panels, or like, oh, it's fine, Shell is building carbon capture plants, so they're going to say, no. So as we are now heading, into this complete climate unknown with the warmest years ever recorded by astounding margins in 2023 and 2024, with the Antarctic ice sheets collapsing. Like, it's all happening now at a crazy pace. Europe headed for 5 degrees of warming. Watched a keynote by a very well-known Dutch transitions guy called Kees Klomp. He was headlining the first inter-university climate summit on Friday last week, and he gave a presentation predicting 19% GDP reduction by within 10 years,
No.
which is basically economic collapse. You cannot address these things without joy. It's like weird to say that, but if you don't do that, then you've already failed.
Yeah, I think another thing that's depressing is a feeling of isolation, and I mean we experience that many, and certainly young people especially experience it so acutely during COVID. But you a sense of being on your own. So I really appreciate that the fourth kind of movement of this curriculum is community building, right? And sharing meals, dancing together, that sort of thing
Yeah.
is something that certainly that I see our students again. Whatever we do, whether it's farming or reading literature or science or whatever, like being together with a group of people who are sharing their lives, sharing their fears, sharing their fun, and those sort of things is that's so fundamentally part of being human, and
Yeah.
education has to reflect that.
Yeah, I agree. And we will figure that out in the, so we are going to do two more pilots next year.
Yeah.
And the so one is to basically for we do a one pilot on to see how we can work with internships, and another pilot to a 2 week full 2 week full-time pilot to see how we do the onboarding and how that will work, and after that we start with a 10 week full-time program. And that is so that these are the building blocks, and use all that data and all the insights to then start with a 10 week full-time program.
So presently, this initiative is independent. It's part of the university, the Erasmus University of Rotterdam, or what is its status as as an
Yeah,
entity?
that's a good question. So we see it as a consortium of different organizations, like we have a big program of vocational school, really large school. We have the University of Applied Sciences, and we have the university, so three educational institutes, and we work with the municipality as well, and different partners to basically run this program, which is hard in a way, because the hardest part is actually where does it fit? Can you say that it's 100% university program? No, because
Other students.
our lecturers come also from not only the students, but also our lecturers come from the different organizations. So it's basically it's a, we have a kind of hybrid form where we got permission to start with a 10 week program with all the groups in it, where actually the students get credits. And how this will play out in the long run, we have no idea. But the idea is to build experience and to create a database so that you can have the data and say, hey, this is what it's doing. Not only in student satisfaction, but also actual results. And hopefully that through that we can scale.
If I can share with you like my vision for how this is gonna like guide us through a period of collapse, I do think that the Dutch universities are now entering what I've called publicly a debt spiral. We're in for €1 billion of funding cuts per year for higher education, which they're also the government is in the process of like eliminating international programs, so we're losing all our international students, so we're losing our top research talent and everything. I don't know that the universities can recover from this, and I don't know that they should. And that's only my opinion. But because one of the problems we tried to address is the fact that universities are built for the world of yesterday, they're hyper specialized, they're rigid and move like, mammoths when it comes to change. And they're designed to produce graduates that contribute to professions that are ultimately completely unsustainable. And the reason that it works in the current system is because of globalization. So Holland can produce an outrageous amount of tax lawyers and econometrists and people with business degrees, because we don't have to. We have machines to produce the food for us, and we can import all our stuff cheaply from China. But when that is no longer the case, because we no longer have fossil fuels to power all of that, we're desperately going to need all hands on deck, to not collapse as a society, basically. And universities, the collapse that I'm seeing now happening with all the shortages of budgets and the student numbers dropping and the quality of education reducing. I see as a terminal decline for the universities. And
I mean, can I interrupt? Or I already did. Sorry. I mean, this is a point where we slightly disagree. So I think that universities as a system will go on and on and on, but it will never ch that it will change, but it's also highly adaptive. So I don't worry about it that much. On the other hand, I think there's a big need for initiatives like what we're doing, and not that we are doing we try to do our best, and there. But what we hope that there are several of these initiatives coming in the Netherlands and Europe, so that the so there's a kind of counterbalance with this large stream, these programs with 400 or 500 first year psychology students or economics or business or law. So that is a kind of balance. And anyway, sorry, I had to interrupt you.
Yeah, I
But
mean,
Jimmy said
it's
you have complementary approaches, right? That's good. Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
see programs with what 500 students in psychology being possible when the world reaches 2.5 degrees of warming, personally. And but what I see is I'm inspired in the way I used to teach political economy, so I'm quite inspired in the way, kind of like as a counterexample, the way neoliberalism like hijacked the scene as soon as Keynesianism was over. And what Milton Friedman, I think, was it that said, or I think it was Milton Friedman who said, like, basically you have to have the idea waiting in the wings for a crisis to like get in there. And what I see as the Bildung Climate School is, well, hey, your model is collapsing, we have another model, maybe this works instead. And I've seen collapse firsthand in Zimbabwe. I'm also really inspired by the story of Cuba and how they avoided a famine after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. So I've spent a lot of time in the past few years studying collapse and looking what collapse looks like and what it does to societies. I do not think that we are at all immune from the kinds of collapse that we have seen. I mean, collapse is the historical norm. If you've read Jared Diamond, that's like whatever goes up has to go down. That's physics. infinite growth, finite planet. Anyways, my point is, I think we really have a model here where if the crisis does become terminal, then we have an alternative. And if the crisis is not terminal, then we also have an alternative, but in a different way. But I think I'm really trying to read between the lines of the IPCC reports and going like, the consequences of these things happening is that education as we know it can no longer exist. And what drove me to do this, why I keep doing this, why I'm investing so much time and effort into this, is because the way we're thinking about the Bildung Climate School, I do think that can survive in a world at 2.5 degrees. Not only can, but can genuinely be like a positive value to society. In a time of deep crisis, in a way that the current university, there will be some university, of course, and they will cater to the very rich and all of that. Like that will still be going on. But I want to like reignite the revolutionary fervor of Christian Kold and Grundtvig, who started the folk high school movements and were like, we can do better. And that's like, that joy. Yeah. Okay. So maybe everything is going to collapse and it's the end of definitely the end of the world as we know it, but hey, we have an alternative coming up in the wings.
That is lovely. Yes, a manifesto there, Ginny. Thank you so much for that. You've mentioned Christian Kold a few times. In Lena's book, there's this kind of picture that I carry around of Christian Kold, he was a bookmaker, right? And then he traveled basically from Trieste all the way across Europe back to Denmark with his wheelbarrow basically full of books, more or less, is that the picture I have in my mind at least. And through the ruins of war, basically, through the revolutions of the 1848 and the continent in dramatic kind of change and collapse. So out of that comes the folk school movement in Denmark. So, well, I'm thank you so much for your time here today, and thank you for your passion and for your vision and the research. I'm so excited to see what comes of it. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.